As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My special guest today is Alice Cooper, godfather of shock rock. And he's been rocking since his teens, forming his first band in Phoenix, Arizona. But he is a native of Detroit, and that's a bond he's kept all these years, and it serves as the inspiration for his upcoming album, Detroit Stories. It's due out in February. Available now, though, is his new single, Rock and Roll, a version of the Velvet Underground song. We'll hear some of it now, followed by our chat on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Jenny said when she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all. Every time she turned on the radio, there was nothing going down at all. Station, couldn't believe what she heard at all. She started shaking to that fine, fine music, and her life was saved by rock and roll. Despite all the amputations, you could just dance to that rock and roll station, and it was all right.
Mighty Manfred here as we get your Coolest Conversations underway. And my very special guest today, singer, songwriter, and the godfather of shock rock, Alice Cooper. Happy New Year to you, Alice.
Thank you, guys. How are you guys doing over there?
Well, as great as can be, I think, considering everything. We're a week into 2021 now. Did you have any New Year's resolutions? And if so, are you still trying to keep them?
You know, I don't make resolutions. I make, you know, kind of like, it would be nice if I... then name it two or three things. I wanted to lose 10 pounds, but COVID took care of that for me.
Oh, man.
I didn't have any of the really bad stuff. I just had exhaustion and loss of appetite. But I'm back now 100% and back out running 3 miles a night and everything like that. So everything's good. But, you know, I mean, I never do any resolutions. I might be... at 73 coming up, I might be kind of done with resolutions. I'm pretty much where I want to be. Yeah.
Well, I hear that. I'm not a big fan of that myself. But I am very happy to hear that, you know, you got through, I mean, you had COVID and you've overcome that. Your family and friends, have they managed to keep healthy?
The whole family got it. But everybody had it for 2 days.
Okay.
And I had it for 4 weeks. You know, so it was just one of those things where, like, again, though, I didn't suffer all of the bad, bad, bad things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the hardest thing was sleeping. You get COVID brain and your brain races and you're trying to sleep at night and you just cannot stop your brain from thinking, you know. But, you know, once that goes, you know, like I said, I can't wait to get back on the road. That's really what...
Oh, I hear that. I want to stick with that just for a second, though, because I haven't heard that, like a brain racing thing. So you're just thinking about everything, or you're concerned specifically about having the disease?
It's just a bombardment of ideas. You can't kind of concentrate on one thing.
Huh.
You just keep getting racing, and that happens for about 3 days, and then it goes away, you know. Okay. But I've heard other people tell me the same thing. They said, okay, I had COVID brain for 3 days. You can't concentrate on anything.
Oh, man. Well, again, we're so happy that this is in the past for you, and you've recovered. We spoke back in 2017, and that was around the
time of the release of Paranormal, your album Paranormal. Since then, you've offered us some breadcrumbs in 2019, the EP Breadcrumbs. And these breadcrumbs, I know, are leading us to the new album, Detroit Stories, but I want to ask you a couple things about that EP, because on there you cover some 60s Detroit songs. You do Bob Seger and the Last Hurds, East Side Story, version of Shorty Long's Devil with a Blue Dress that Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels had rocked up. You do a couple of 70s things, Sister Ann from the MC5, Susie Quattro's Your Mama Won't Like Me. And then also, I guess part of the Devil with a Blue Dress goes right into this J.J. Barnes tune, Soul Man, J.J. Barnes, Chains of Love. Such a cool song. I was surprised, you know, that really wasn't a hit. Why did you do that one?
Well, you know, it was really the whole idea of the Detroit album was to do everything in Detroit with all Detroit players about Detroit and record it there. And you know, so I had, you know, Johnny B on drums. You know, I had all Wayne Kramer on guitar. Yeah. And of course, I had some, my original band, I consider them a Detroit band because we broke out of Detroit, even though we're from Phoenix. 18 came out of Detroit on CKLW. And so we were, and I'm from Detroit, so it's one of those things where we were considered a Detroit band more than an LA band or a Phoenix band. We were a Detroit band because we fit right in with the Stooges and the MC5 and those bands, you know. But the whole idea behind the thing was to find songs. We researched a whole bunch of, there was a band called the Electric Six, is it?
Yeah, they're a current band, right? The Electric Six from
Great
Detroit.
Band. Really, yeah. Really good band. And we looked at all these punk bands and we just said, I want to pick up on songs that are Detroit based. So that song came up, and I love the idea of going from not Mitch Ryder's version of Devil with a Blue Dress. We made it much more Rat Pack, you know.
Yeah.
And then going into that song just seemed normal.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Chains of Love got a hold on me. You know, it's not an Alice Cooper song at all. But I said that, well, that's kind of makes it Detroit. You know, let's go where we don't go, where we haven't gone before.
Well, right. And I think, too, that Detroit, you think of, you know, the rock sounds are there. But, of course, there's a lot of deep soul in there. And you kind of bridge that with the EP, certainly, you know, and kind of a whole presentation of the Motor City's musics.
Well, you know, here's the thing about Detroit. And I realized this when I got into the session. We were actually recording it in Royal Oak in Detroit. And here's these guitar players that are just monster guitar players, rock and roll guys, born into rock and roll, Detroit. And yet there's a certain amount of that R&B in their DNA.
Yeah.
And I'd listen back to, we'd be playing some real hard rock thing and you'd hear that little bit of R&B in it, you know? And I said, let's leave that. I want that because that's part of being in Detroit. When we used to play the Grandy or the East Town Theater, in 1970, you know, 69, 70, 71 with, you know, the Stooges, the MC5, Seger, Nugent, and then the headliner would be like The Who or Savoy Brown or somebody like that.
Yeah.
I'd look down the audience and there's Smokey. And there's one of the Supremes. Yeah. And there's two of the guys from the Temptations. Because they loved the hard rock thing. And then when they would be playing, you know, a bunch of us rock guys would go down and listen to them. And we were totally accepted. If you were in music in Detroit, there was no color. It was like you were just, you were a brother, you know, and you were not dangerous. You were not the enemy. So during the riots, you could walk into any black bar downtown if you were in a band and they saw you as being black. They saw you as being one of them because you're in the music business and you're not the enemy.
So you were born in Detroit. You moved to Phoenix. How old were you when you moved to Phoenix?
I was 10. I had asthma, and I had to get out of that cold climate. So I moved to Phoenix, and it burned it out of me. And, you know, it's a funny thing. I never had another asthma attack, you know, the rest of my life. And but the only place that really would accept Alice Cooper, we kind of got drummed out of L.A. You know, L.A. had the Doors. And they had Love, and they had Buffalo Springfield. You know, San Francisco had, you know, Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead. New York had the Rascals, and they had all, you know, that. Detroit was the hard rock capital. That's where, if you were not a hard rock band in Detroit with attitude, they really didn't care about you at all. In other words, you know, Seals and Croft would have gotten killed in Detroit.
Well, what I'm trying to get here is you move down to Phoenix, and you start playing there, I guess the Earwigs, and there comes the Spiders and such.
Right.
And this is, you know, 64, 65, even putting out a couple of singles. Did you have family still back in Detroit? Were you able to kind of keep your finger on what some of the local bands were there at the time, your peers, really?
At the time, no. In Phoenix, we were trying to go to school. Yeah. We were trying to run cross country and track. We were trying to graduate. And we played every weekend at the VIP club. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about the VIP club was we were the Spiders. Spiders will be playing the new Rolling Stone songs. And we're still in high school. And we opened for the Byrds, the Lovin' Spoonful, the Hollies. And then one night, the promoter says, okay, next week I got the Yardbirds in. And we went, what? He says, the Yardbirds. Well, we happened to be the Yardbirds band in Phoenix. We played all Yardbirds songs. In this little 1,000-seater, well, it was held about 1,000 people. There was a stage on one end, a stage on the other end. And we went on before and played all their songs. And they were in the back, and here's Jeff Beck. You know, Jeff Beck is a hot rod at that point. He's like 19, and Jimmy Page and the whole thing. And they're giving us the thumbs up, and then they got on stage and blew us off the stage.
Oh, wow.
Because they were the Yardbirds, the Yardbirds at their most vicious.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what an experience, though, to open for the Yardbirds. Come on.
Oh, all these bands is phenomenal. You had a chance to play with them. You mentioned now about, you know, playing a Rolling Stone song. I can't recall how you just made
it. It was 19 Nervous Breakdown. And when that came out, we learned it immediately. And, of course, that was the advertisement. This weekend at the VIP, the Spiders will be playing 19th Nervous Breakdown, you know.
Well, as the Spiders, I want to ask you this question regarding the Spiders, because Jerry Marsden from Jerry and the Pacemakers just recently passed, and that first single that you guys did, Hitchhike, it's backed with Why Don't You Love Me, and I kept reading about that being a Jerry and the Pacemakers song, but I think the track is on the soundtrack to their movie, Ferry Across the Mersey, but the actual band that did it was some other English band called the Blackwells.
A band that never really went anywhere, but the song kind of like resonated with us, and we said, well, why don't we cover that, you know, that song? It just seemed like something that we would do, and because we're already doing a bit of a Rolling Stone remake, you know, because they're Stones, yeah. You know, and that song, I said, nobody's going to know this song. So let's do this one, you know.
So the Breadcrumbs EP, when that comes out, was that like a precursor to set us up for the full-fledged Detroit Stories?
Absolutely. That's why it was Breadcrumbs. Bob Ezrin said, why don't we leave Breadcrumbs, leading them to the next album? And I had never done an EP before.
I noticed that. I looked at your discography.
So I said, well, what do you mean? He said, let's do 6 songs. Four of them might not be on the album, but it's going to lead us right into this Detroit album. And I went, oh, that's a great idea. Because we were between albums. It was at a time when we didn't want to release the Detroit album right then. Hmm. You know, we really wanted to make the Detroit album a real sort of rock kind of masterpiece documentary about Detroit. And even though it's not about Detroit, It's everything about it is Detroit.
Yeah.
You know, when you hear the guitar work on it, Bonamassa played on it, and Steve Hunter, and guys like that. And it's very guitar driven, you know, so it's a rock and roll album. So, and that's the thing, but it goes in a lot of directions. There's a blues song in there, you know, our Love Will Change the World is the weirdest song ever.
We'll go out with that. I was going to ask you about that in a couple of minutes. But in fact, this week, our coolest song in the world is your version of the Lou Reed song, the Velvet Underground tune, Rock and Roll. And I love how in there you changed the location from New York City to Detroit, because, you know, Jenny said when she was just 5 years old, her life was saved by rock and roll, and she's listening to the radio station. So Jenny, she was 5 years old when her life was saved by rock and roll. How old are you?
Well, I'll tell you, I was about that when Elvis came out. You know, I was, Ed Sullivan, of course, was Sunday night. And here was this guy, Elvis Presley, comes on, and there was all the controversy around him. And as soon as I saw him, I went back in my bedroom and started imitating him. I put a comb in my hair a little bit like that, and I started imitating him. And then my Uncle Vince, who was a Damon Runyon character, I mean, he was right out of Guys and Dolls. He was a lightweight boxer, played guitar. He could have been in Guys and Dolls easily. We did, I spent all this time at the track, you know, and comes over one day and he goes, "You like Elvis?" He goes, "Yeah." He said, "You're going to love this." He puts on, you know, Chuck Berry.
Oh, cool.
And I went, "Oh man, that's a whole other thing." 'Cause what was leading the song was guitar.
Yeah.
Not horns and vocal. It was that guitar that changed everything.
So I was asking you about Bob Ezrin, your producer. You've worked with other producers over the years, but really, Alice, is it an Alice Cooper album if he's not involved?
You know, the only person that understands Alice Cooper, the character, more than me is Bob Ezrin, or as much as me. Yeah. Because, I mean, everybody, we know what Alice is, should do, what his personality is, how he would say it. How he wouldn't say that, how he wouldn't step on that subject. He would keep it here. There's little boundaries around Alice Cooper where he won't go, and then other places where he'd gladly go, you know. And so when we're writing a song, we'll go through the lyrics and this and this and this, and Bob would say, "Alice wouldn't say that, would he?" And I go, "No, he wouldn't. Let's change that." You know, or he would say, "Does this sound like something Alice would sing?" We'd get halfway through the track and go, "Absolutely not. We're trying to put a square peg into a round hole."
Yeah.
The songs that really end up being Alice Cooper songs are the ones that you play it once or twice and go, "Oh my gosh, that is so down the middle. That's so Alice." School's Out was written in 15 minutes, you know. Yeah. It was just so right there. But Bob is the only guy that honestly, when I was working with Roy Thomas Baker, when I was working with, you know, David Foster, I would run the songs past Bob Ezrin first.
Because
he was my George Martin, you know?
Yeah.
He was working on The Who, he was working on Pink Floyd or Kiss or somebody, and couldn't do the album. And so I would run the songs, and he would send me notes back. He says, "This bridge, I don't know, it doesn't support the chorus." Or, "This chorus is too long," or, "Get to the point. Don't bore us. Get to the chorus," you know. And all those notes I would really take very seriously, because he knows Alice as much as I do. We created him together in the studio, you know.
Well, let's talk some about some of these other players on there. You mentioned their names. Steve the Deacon Hunter.
Yes.
There on Rock and Roll. He was also in the Lou Reed Band. I know he's spent a lot of time with you playing on your albums over the years. You guys were covering rock and roll. Has he ever shared any Lou Reed stories with you?
You know, the Deacon is one of those guys that he was my go-to guy on every album. If there was a place where I really, well, I can tell you an example of this. We had a song called "I Am Made of You" that I wrote with Desmond Child and Bob. And I tried to explain this to him. I said, "Okay, Steve, I Say Goodbye to Love by the Carpenters. The solo on that, it takes the theme and it builds on it and builds on it and builds on it, but it stays in the theme." I said, "Can you do that with this song?" He nailed it. I couldn't have even thought of a better solo than this solo. But Steve Hunter is one of those guys that if you talk to any other guitar player, in fact, Joe Bonamassa at one point said, "I get to play with Steve Hunter." You know, he's got that reputation for being just one of the guys, like a Jay Graydon, you know, one of those guys, you know, that's sort of not in the spotlight, mm-hmm. but everybody knows the guitar. He played the guitar solo on Aerosmith's Train Kept a Rollin'. And he's just one of those guys that's the best of the best. So Deacon, he never really talked about Lou. The craziest story I can tell you about Lou is the fact I lived at the Chelsea Hotel when he did. and with the, you know, when Nico and everybody lived there, and we would actually come back to our rooms and they would be sitting outside the door, the keys in the door, but they don't have the energy to turn the key and get in. And we would literally, I said at least three or four times with Nico, I'd turn the key, we'd pick her up, put her in her room, throw the key in and lock the door. Same with Lou. But the last time I saw Lou, we're at some kind of a thing, you know, and he's sitting there going, he goes, "Hey, Alice, how you doing? Good." He says, "Hey, look, I'm pushing the ball to the right a little bit." And I went, "What?" And he says, yeah, I play golf now. You know, and I said, "Well, relax your right hand and it'll release the club." You know, but I said, "Will we be having this conversation 20 years ago at the Chelsea?" No. But, you know, what a difference. I always liked Lou. You know, Lou is really the heart of New York. I've always thought he was sort of the heart and the soul of New York. And he would not have minded me changing that to Detroit.
Yeah, very good. We got to give the drummer some here. You mentioned Johnny B. He's on the Traps. This guy playing with Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, I think. Maybe he started when he was like 16 or 17. Oh. He's also got a long history with you as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Anytime I could use Johnny, you know, he's one of those guys that plays just enough behind the beat. Mm-hmm. And he's one of those guys that has that R&B thing that you can't explain. You can't really put it into words. It's just there, you know. Same with Wayne Kramer. Wayne Kramer plays great lead guitar, but there's some R&B in there that you probably wouldn't be able to ever get him not to play like that. But I was surprised at how good a guitar player Wayne's better now than he ever was with the MC5.
And I mean, you have him on the record playing on y'all's version of Sister Ann, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know, and I was really glad to hear that there was a harp on there, so I got to play harmonica with
So tell me about a bit more about Detroit Stories. Let me get this straight. When did you record the album? And you did do it in Detroit?
Yeah, we did it in Detroit, and a year and a half ago, you know, we were making the album there. We were doing the bed tracks, and I did pretty much everything right there, you know, in Detroit, because I said, I want this to be as authentic as possible. I had two aunts that lived two blocks away. I mean, that's how Detroit it was. Wow. And once you get to Detroit, you realize that's why it's the hard rock capital. You know, it just, people there are, most of the families somehow generated out of the factories, you know, the cars. And kids would walk around the street with the black leather jackets and the long black hair. Whereas if you were in Los Angeles and a Detroit band would come in, the kids would go home, put on the black leather jacket and try to look like Detroit. But Detroit kids are actually that. Yeah. You know, and there's a certain amount, I think it has something to do with the machinery, you know, the constant machinery, where that's why metal and hard rock is really big there. It speaks to them. And it speaks to me. I've never lost my love for a gigantic Pete Townsend power chord, you know.
You know, this reminds me, you mentioned that the factories there, and I'm not going to say the name of the book's title properly, but it just came out through Norton Records Publishing. It's talking about the Fortune Records story, which was Fortune Records was based there, and they recorded lots of R&B, but they also recorded lots of country music, hillbilly and rockabilly stuff. And it's kind of like a Sun Records story, except they never had, you know, an Elvis or a Jerry Lee Lewis or so forth.
We never had
I don't know if you're familiar with this book or not, the Fortune Records story. It's you know, there was this couple that ran it, a husband-wife team, and part of the book is kind of their love story. She was sort of a frustrated performer, and she became the principal songwriter. She wrote all these, co-wrote all these R&B songs and some country songs. And I guess the thing I got out of this was that I wasn't familiar with it. Often heard the story of, you know, blacks coming from the rural South to the North to work in these factories, but also at the same time, it was all these poor whites moving to Detroit as well, working in the factories and doing their own music. And both those sides are explored in the book, and I highly recommend it. If it's, I mean, it's like a textbook sized thing, but it's definitely worth going through.
My mom ran away from Glen Mary, Tennessee, and my and her sister when they were 16 to Detroit to work in the factories. She says, all I remember when I was a little girl was putting clear liquid in ball jars for my dad. Because they were, you know, he was a moonshiner, you know. And at one point, she said, I've got to get out of here. She ran away, moved to Detroit, met my dad. But she worked in the factories, lied about her age. She was working there when she was 16. And, you know, and that's how I became a Detroiter. You know, it was just what you were talking about. People running away, you know, ending up in Detroit and bringing their own culture there.
At that, absolutely. Well, on the on Detroit stories, we mentioned, we talked about some of these tracks off the EP are on there. Rock and Roll, the version that you guys do of the tune, that's on there. We're going to go out in a moment with the tune that you had mentioned, Our Love Will Change the World. Now, the balance of these tracks, so I wasn't given an advanced copy of, I haven't heard. And I was curious, out of the balance of those tunes, how many of those are your songs and how many have other people contributed to? Is it mostly yourself working with some of the other musicians, or where do these other songs come from?
Tommy Hendrickson, who's in my band, my guitar player, comes up with a lot of songs. And, you know, we took pieces of this and pieces of that. And Bob and I are really good about finding the best piece in that song. Maybe the whole song runs along, you go, that's that. And, ooh, what's that? You know, and grab that piece. And then another song. But Tommy's a good songwriter where he can actually bring in a full song.
Yeah.
You know? I would say 75% of the album, Ezra and myself, Tommy, writing on it. And we just came up with characters like Hamtramck Hammer, you know, Painkiller Jane, and characters like that that would have been in Detroit. Hamtramck is a city in Detroit.
Right, a Polish kind of neighborhood, right, Hammer, predominantly.
Hamtramck Hammer. This guy is like, that's what he calls himself. And he goes out with Painkiller Jane. and it's just one of those things where you created characters that you kind of knew. And yeah. We're going to create this guy. And so there's a lot of characters like that.
But I'm looking at the track listing now. What song is that with those two characters?
That's Go Man Go.
All right. Okay.
And it's almost rockabilly, you know.
Yeah.
But it fits right in with him. He gets out of jail, steals a Hellcat, picks up his girlfriend. They're going as fast as they can. They pass a cop, and he says, I guess I should slow down. She goes, no, man, go. They have to outrun a train. The train's coming. And he says, should I put on the brakes or step on the gas? And she goes, go, man, go.
All right. Well, you mentioned a blues kind of feeling number on there. What is that? Is that $1,000 high heel shoes or
no, what? But that one is pure R&B. We did that on purpose. Yeah. We had some of the black girls singing on it. And we had a horn section right out of Detroit. And it's about an Uber driver that spends all of his money on his girlfriend's high heel shoes. And you'd think he'd be complaining, but he's not. He says, because she looks great with a little collar in her high heels. Of course, she's wearing nothing else. But... But we made it.
He couldn't afford to buy or anything else.
He says, my entire fortune is walking around on her feet.
Yeah. Well, very cool. And so the new album, I believe it's out February the 26th.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. A couple of other things. I just read in Rolling Stone magazine online earlier this week that you had written a song for Harry Nilsson's son, Zach, and boy, he's having a hard time suffering from end-stage colon cancer, and he's chosen to enter hospice instead of continuing the treatment. But the video clip of you singing the song, it aired on a YouTube channel, and Zach is on there as well. Your song, the performance, really charming and lovely. Can you tell us about that?
I was, you know, Harry was one of my very best friends. He was an original Hollywood vampire, him and John, and, you know, all the guys, Keith Moon, everybody. But Harry was the guy that never missed being there. And he was one of my very, very best friends. And when I heard about this, I didn't want to just send a hey, you know, Zach, feel better. It was, I was taking my family to Tombstone. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a weekend, go to Tombstone. And on the way, my daughter Calico is there, who's a Vista Blanco. And we started writing this song. I said, let's just write a song for him. And she's in the back seat and we're humming it. We wrote the whole song on the way to Tombstone. And I said, when we get back now, all we need is just a piano. All we need is just like a Harry Nilsson kind of chord thing. Yeah. And I think it will speak to him, because what I think the main point of the thing was, your dad would have written a song about you because you were more important to him than anything else. And I think that was the thing and I didn't want it produced. I wanted it really just one take.
Yeah. You know?
And that's all it was. We could have made it into a big production, but under the circumstances, I thought it was better just as a private little note to him saying that I knew your dad and your dad thought the world of you, you know?
Very sweet. And you can see his reaction to it, and they, you know, they talk about it afterwards. What a cool thing to do.
Well, it might be a song that I might actually, you know, produce. It might, because it's pretty cute little song, but
it is. And you're right. It does have a very Nielsen-esque quality to it. You know,
I could hear all the background vocals in it. I could hear all the stuff that should be in there. And then I said, well, right now, but this version's got to be personal. It's got to be just for him.
Well, tell us about that. A little bit more. I want to make sure people understand that when you say, you know, you're hanging out with Harry Nilsson and John, that means John Lennon and Keith Moon. And so you guys had quite the, I don't know if it's your version of a Rat Pack, but that went on for several years in the early 70s, didn't it?
Yeah, at the Rainbow Bar and Grill. And upstairs was the Lair of the Vampires. Now, we used to go there every night to drink. That just seemed to be the place where everybody met. And it was always, Mickey Dolenz, Bernie Taupin, myself, and Harry was always there. And it was Harry was there. If John was in town, that meant John was there. So he was a vampire. Ringo would show up once in a while. T-Rex. We knew who the drinkers were.
Yeah.
And sort of that was like the home away from home. And the waitress there, she says, you know, nobody ever sees you guys during the daytime. We only see you at night, and all you do is drink. So I said, that's what a vampire does. And they said, yeah, the Hollywood vampires. And so, of course, that carried over to the band with Johnny Depp and Joe Perry. I said, you know, let's keep that thing alive, and let's just do songs from our dead drunk friends.
Well, thankfully, you've been sober for a long while now, right?
37 years.
37 years. Well, congratulations with that. When you mentioned Lou Reed, he was talking about pushing the ball to the right a little bit. And I know you're an avid golfer, and I may have asked this question before, but I'm going to have to ask it again. Kid Leo, you know, longtime DJ, he was on the air in Cleveland for many years, and he's on the air here in the Underground Garage and the program director. He's a very, very avid golfer. I think the only reason he got his hip replacement done was so that he could still, you know, make it out to the course. Have you guys ever played golf together?
Yes, we have. When he was a DJ in Cleveland, was it, or Boston? Cleveland.
Cleveland, yeah.
And we went out to play, and I wish, if you ever get a chance, to videotape him getting ready to hit the ball. He does this little dance that I've never seen anybody do. It's the craziest little kind of setup he does. He does this little kind of moves his feet around and then he hits the ball. And he hits it pretty good. But yeah, Leo is one of my favorite guys. I love listening to Leo's show. He's a little bit old school, which I love. And he knows where all the bodies are buried.
Okay, so new album, Detroit Stories, out February the 26th, and I want to go out with a track off of it. You mentioned this song earlier, Our Love Will Change the World. Very positive song in dour times. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, it's such a happy track.
Yeah.
You know, it's so bouncy and full of life. And then you start listening to the lyrics, and you go, wait a minute. His lyrics are extremely subversive. It's almost like, it's getting better all the time. I used to be bad. the song is very happy, and the lyrics are talking about him beating his wife, his girlfriend, and, you know, all this other stuff. But this one here is talking about like a generation looking at my generation, kind of like Children of the Damned, you know, and going, yeah, you guys are done. We're going to create something entirely new. And don't worry, you'll get used to it. Our love will change the world. And in time, you'll understand it. You know, it was a very kind of like futuristic generational thing, dismissing us, you know, which to me was extremely subversive. And yet it's like getting play on BBC. I mean, you know, you can't get on BBC for anything. And it's like in heavy rotation over there. I think it's because the song is so happy sounding.
Yeah. Well, so did you come up with the lyrics for that?
Yeah, I wrote the lyrics. I did surgery on the lyrics. Let's put it that way. Okay. The lyrics came like that. And I don't honestly think that the writer understood what a juxtaposition this was against these dark lyrics against this happy sound. And I did some surgery on him to make him a little more Alice. I think he accidentally wrote a masterpiece.
Well, very cool. We're going to go out with that. But first, Alice, thank you so, so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Oh, thank you so much, man. It's always great to talk to you. And I listen to you every day.
Oh, I appreciate that. All right. Here's Alice Cooper. Our Love Will Change the World, off the upcoming album Detroit Stories, in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
We have very little respect for everything, very little regard for anything. We've got something against so much, and we're only beginning. Our mind's a cynical machine now. So it seems, 'cause that's how we're living.
Our love will change the world. That's Alice Cooper off his upcoming album Detroit Stories, due out Friday, February the 26th. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and many thanks again to Alice for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our segment. And please be sure and join me next time around for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Don't let it decide, baby, diamond ring.